back to Expert Instruction, the Teach by Design podcast, where we dive deeper into the research surrounding student behavior by talking with the people implementing these practices, where they work, and with the students they support. I'm Megan Cave.
I'm Danielle Triplett.
Well, Danielle, here we are. We're back with another episode of our Mythbuster series.
So popular. People love it.
So good. Our guest today is Dr. Chris Borgmeier. Mm-hmm. He's our friend from Portland State University, right?
Yes, that's my alma mater, by the way.
Oh my God.
Yes.
He was a grad student here at the U of O, and now he is up there in Portland doing wonderful work. For a long time now, his focus, or what we know him best for, is all about function and why students are doing the thing that they're doing, and starting to put together some supports based on that function.
Yeah.
And so we knew when we were talking about this topic today, we had to talk to him.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he was, thank you, Chris, by the way, you responded like within hours. Like, I think I was down here in Eugene. We're like, well, I'll email him. And he was like, on it. So we were really excited to talk to him more and learn about this and learn about the history of how FBAs kind of came to be along with PBIS. Mm-hmm. You know, both were written into the IDEA law in 1997 for the first time. And so we've got decades of doing this work, and yet there's still a need. There's still new educators and new folks out there who are like, help me understand this. What's an FBA? Why do I need to know about this? And I think he broke it down in a way that it really comes to, first, one of the rules is we never do an FBA without also having a plan. And that plan should be a PBIS plan, something to really support the kids. And the goal of it is to have a function-based support plan. So we can say, okay, we've got this kiddo, Megan, and let's understand why she's doing what she's doing and have a plan in place to meet her needs.
That's right. And just to piggyback on that too, is that the thing that I really took away from this episode is that we can think about the formal assessment, right? The formal FBA as the thing that's legally required for any student who is on an IEP.
Yep.
Who has missed school for more than 10 days related to a disciplinary action. I think that's what he had talked to us about in this episode. And so we could do that, or we can also do more, that we can actually shift from thinking about FBA as a formal process, and we can actually start to think about function-based as an adjective in our work.
Yes.
And so we have function-based assessments that we do. We have function-based support plans that we can provide. We can do function-based thinking in our classrooms where we start to really think about, why is my student doing that? We can develop a function-based understanding of what's happening in our school. So I really liked that while the FBA feels like a more formal process, function-based whatever is something that we can do with any of us could do anytime with any student anywhere.
Yeah, and it has lots of benefits in our classrooms, in our lives as we interact with any humans, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
So we were so grateful to have Chris join us today. He's breaking it down for us.
Yeah.
He's given us the history, the definitions, and he's trying to help us through exploring this myth that FBA is only for special education.
Right.
And so I would venture to say that we busted that myth.
Agreed.
Today. But you listen in and you tell us what you think. Well, thanks for joining us today, Chris. We're so happy to have you on this episode with us.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for the invitation. And I've long admired the work of Teach by Design. So thank you.
Oh, great. We've referenced your work. We're referencing it this month as we're talking about motivation and recording all of that information as part of referrals that get entered into Swiss, let's say. And so your work is well received over here and something that we've looked at for a really long time. So we're grateful to have you here to talk to us about this myth that we think people might have in their minds that we would like to either confirm or bust with you today. And that myth is FBAs, functional behavioral assessments, are only for special education. And so I guess before we dive into some of the details around that, we just thought we'd open up by asking you where you think this idea comes from, that this kind of assessment only happens when students are referred for special education.
Yeah, why do people out there have this in their heads? Why do people think this?
Well, it's, it comes right out of special education law. I don't think anybody ever, functional behavioral assessment was not terminology or a concept in education until it was actually introduced in the 1997 reauthorization of IDEA. Mm-hmm. And so that's the first time functional behavioral assessment showed up in the law or in many, probably any educational context. It's also the first time positive behavior support was referenced in the law.
Oh.
And so, and they were hand in hand. And so functional behavioral assessment was intended as a safeguard, as a protection for students with IEPs. And so the idea was, we shouldn't be able to just continue to suspend or expel or deprive kids with IEPs of their IEP services for behavioral and disciplinary reasons. And so functional behavioral assessment, based on at that time, probably 30 years of research, was identified as the best way to understand how to intervene with students. And so it was introduced through special education law, and positive behavior support was introduced because we wanted to move away from more punishment-based interventions for the same population of students. And so that introduced an emphasis on prevention and earlier intervention for students to be proactive and try to prevent problem behaviors. But the way that it was really interpreted and understood, I think, when the law came out was the law sort of stipulated that students with IEPs could miss up to 10 days of school for disciplinary reasons. And so once they exceeded 10 days, then a functional behavioral assessment was required and a positive behavior support plan to try to, prevent the kids from missing their IEP services, which by law they should be able to access. So, mm-hmm. So it was a legal protection for these IEP students. And the intention of that is very good, right? The intention is let's maintain these students' access to their IEP services, and let's provide them the behavior supports that they need. However, it became kind of interpreted as like a legal compliance. The legal side of it kind of took over, and a lot of schools and districts sort of interpreted it as we have 10 days. And then we should do something, when the idea was to be more proactive and to say, hey, if we have kids heading in that direction, why don't we do a positive behavior support plan based on functional behavioral assessment and prevent the kids from getting into that sort of place of legal compliance? But and this is terminology I would hear, over the years, was sort of, we have this 10 days to give. And so we have 10 days, and then if we hit that legal limit, then we should do a functional behavioral assessment. So what that made it into was really a last resort process that we use, because it became really oriented around the legal compliance side.
Yeah.
And we certainly know that legal compliance is big and an important aspect of special education, but mm-hmm. it's also very punitive. So I would say that in some ways this has limited the use of functional behavioral assessment, because people see it as only something we do in the most severe cases.
Yeah, that's been my experience with it. I mean, I come to this as a non-educational person, is how I was first introduced to this acronym of FBA. And it seemed to me at the time that I first heard about it, that this is something that is a big deal. It is something that you do in rare instances and takes time and experience. And I think it's what you're speaking to, which is that it's like, it's an escalation. And so mm-hmm. now you have to do it, as opposed to what it actually could be. Because I was, after we had a conversation with you, last week. And so as you were talking about the legal requirements of it, I started to look just a little bit, just so that I felt a little bit more comfortable having a conversation today. And that 10 days really stuck out to me, that like, oh, it's after 10 days of missing school for discipline. Like, a 10 days of suspension.
That's a long time.
Now you're going to do something mm-hmm. about it. Mm-hmm. Now you're going to get someone on a plan. Feels too late. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, but the compliance side of things is it's so punitive and it's very scary, you know, going to due process as a special education teacher or administrator. And so that side of it has almost made special education administrators like gatekeepers. And so oftentimes, well, we only train school psychologists to do FBAs, or only BCBAs can do FBAs. And it's really limited it to that realm of special education. I do trainings, you know, all over the place, and I'm up leading trainings, and people are saying, "Oh, well, I can't do FBAs in my district because I'm not this or I'm not that," and so people are very sort of nervous around it because of the legal compliance, which has limited people's access to understanding. And in preparation programs, you don't see FBA being trained to general educators or even school counselors in many cases. The only people who oftentimes get it is school psychologists and maybe special educators in some special ed licensure programs. So,
Well, so let's fast forward. I think this is fascinating to hear about the history. And I remember, you know, I started doing this work. I started teaching in 2005 and joined the PBIS team at my school. And I remember it was kind of like our special ed teacher was the team lead. And I remember, I'm just thinking back to these days. And Chris, you worked with our school, so I've known you a long time. In East Multnomah County. But I remember thinking like, oh, PBIS shouldn't be a special ed thing. Like as a general ed language arts teacher, I drank the Kool-Aid. I got it. I was like, no, we all need this. We don't want to wait until it gets up to this level. Like, let's do more to be proactive and preventative. So just really reminded of that. But I'm curious now in, you know, 2026, 30 some years later from passing that initial law, like what is an FBA? Tell us what it is in the current context. Like what is an FBA? What's the purpose? And why do we conduct them in schools as you see it now?
So a functional behavioral assessment is just an assessment, right? Per its title. And one of the things I want to sort of caveat right away is, I never want to hear functional behavioral assessment without behavior support plan right next to it. Mm-hmm. And we can combine those and say function-based support, because the only real reason to do a functional behavioral assessment is to inform an intervention plan. That is the whole purpose of FBA, is to understand what is, why is the student engaging in these behaviors, and what are the factors contributing to the student's behavior. And so a functional behavioral assessment uses what we call the ABC framework. So it's antecedents, behaviors, consequences. And then through understanding of the antecedents, behaviors, consequences, we understand the function. And so antecedents are just the triggers to behavior. And so what we're looking for is, what are those things that are directly, triggering the student's behavior within the environment? And so it might be that math worksheet that's too difficult. It might be asking the student to read aloud. And so functional behavioral assessment is trying to identify the patterns of behavior that help us understand what is likely to set the student up to engage in behavior. And then what's the response that the student's getting, that they're learning, hey, this is making this behavior functional, worthwhile, right? Mm-hmm. And so they engage in the behavior. So say we give them that math problem that they're struggling with, they engage in problem behavior. We say, go sit out in the hallway, and the student's like,
sweet, don't got to do that. Yeah. Don't do that worksheet.
It's the payoff, right? They get
paying off for me. And so essentially we're the functional behavioral assessment is usually more formally, it's, a behavior specialist is maybe starting with a records review and then doing an interview with the teachers and staff involved. That might be it should be followed up with an observation of the student in the setting where the behaviors of concern. And then you might do, interview with some other staff members or an interview with the student. So those are most, many of the common features of a functional behavioral assessment. But it's really to understand an assessment, to understand what are those things that are contributing to occurrence of the behavior, and what's the function. Why is it paying off for the student?
Great. And so the reason we conduct them is to inform the intervention and the plan that we create, that they go hand in hand. It And where the misconception might be coming from is that FBA is part of a legal requirement related to special education. And so as such, lots of times people implement it after those 10 days of suspension as a legal compliance rather than as a way to inform a plan. Mm-hmm. I gotcha.
I like that. And I wrote down the goal is it's kind of combining these terms of FBA and PBIS, and the goal is function-based support plan for our kiddos. Yeah. Love it.
Yeah.
And and what you see sometimes in the compliance is, you know, we get to those 10 days and people say, oh, we got to do a functional behavioral assessment, but it's really about what's the plan. We need to do some of the plan. And
we have to do something.
And from the compliance side, what you see a lot of times is people will say, oh, before we can move the student to this more restrictive placement, we need to do a functional behavioral assessment. But it's not a tool for deciding, should we change placement? You know, those decisions in an MTSS framework should only be made after, you know, it's response to intervention. Is the student responding to the interventions that we came up? And that's where, you know, function behavior assessment and behavior support plans can be really helpful for informing interventions even before a student is being evaluated for special education. But we don't see it or use it oftentimes that way because, again, it's people see it as so restricted to use only in those most extreme cases.
Mm-hmm. And the behavior support plan is not built into the law.
It is a functional behavioral assessment in the law. It's always paired with a positive behavior support plan.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's always that connection, but sometimes you see it kind of used in isolation or talked about in isolation, and that should really never be the case.
Mm-hmm. So what I hear from you, though, is that even though the law says that we should do this after 10 days for students who have an IEP, after 10 days of a disciplinary action taking them out of school, that perhaps this is something, an FBA is something that we could do way earlier. And I think our question is it something that we would only do for students who have an IEP, or is it something that we could do for any student? And when would you decide that an FBA would be an important thing to conduct?
Mm. Yeah, so we, because the term function behavioral assessment is so tied to the special education side, a lot of times we talk about like function-based assessment or function-based thinking or function-based support as a way to try to expand the way people think about it. But you know, the real, you know, what I see is the real shame is we have this really powerful technology. We, you know, built on 50 years or more of research that basically says, you know, the best way for us to identify how to support students behaviorally with the most direct impact is through function-based understanding. And so we absolutely want to expand use of this outside of those most extreme cases. So we talk about, you know, doing it for students with IEPs before they're at any risk whatsoever of being at that 10-day mark of suspension. Mm-hmm. Doing it for kids, you know, before they have IEPs, as a, you know, within a MTSS framework, again, you know, that could be one of the deciders is if we can implement a function-based support plan for a student with the existing general education resources, maybe we don't even need to elevate this to a special education evaluation or need. Mm-hmm. And that is probably one of the best strategies that we have for matching kids to what they need. Even previous to special education. Mm-hmm. And then we can also, there are ways we can utilize it in like tier two and tier one. You know, I train my students as special educators to do formal functional behavioral assessment, which is, you know, the interviews and the observations. And usually that's because they're going into a different context and they're like observing a student in someone else's classroom, right? So you have a little bit more to learn, but I always tell them that the we have you do this formally, but my hope is that the greatest benefit to you is that you're able to use it informally, regularly. And so, mm-hmm. so you're able to say, hey, I've got the student in my class. And, you know, during that math group we have, the student's engaged in this behavior 6 or 7 times in the last week. Can I just slow down and say, hey, have I noticed anything about what's triggering the behavior? Mm-hmm. and what the behavior is, and then what's the response and what's the student learning from that response. And so not doing an interview, not doing a formal observation of any kind, but just being able to apply it to my own students by slowing down and looking for some of those patterns that then I can, you know, direct me towards, you know, probably the most practical and parsimonious interventions I can implement.
Mm-hmm. I like what you said, too, about how you might be able to utilize some general education resources
sure.
to implement a new plan for someone that you don't, it doesn't have to be that you need this level of support, like some specific level of support, just because we're looking at the function of your behavior that, I think it's really true that mm-hmm. ever since I've understood or learned about what it means that behavior is a response to a context, mm-hmm. that I, in my own life and every day, I just start to think about that. Like, why would someone keep doing the thing, you know, mm-hmm. whether it's my kids or my husband or a friend or a colleague or whatever, they're doing something that I think, well, that seems a little strange. And mm-hmm. they keep doing that thing. And I often do find myself thinking, well, why are they doing it like that?
Mm-hmm.
And it leads to think about, like, what is my role in this? And how is there something that I could do that would be a small change that could actually get us all on the same page about something? So it's true. Mm-hmm. Thinking about function, as soon as you learn about it, I do think it starts to play out just more casually in the way that we conduct ourselves in life. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I can't help but think about this, Chris, and the idea of that. One thing that stuck with me about PBIS over the years has been that it's really about the adult behavior more than the kid behavior. Like, that's what's in our control, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm thinking about, how we would sort of bring this to our general education teachers, who really, I think we all are educators, want to understand our kiddos. And that's where sometimes these labels come into play. Like, oh, this kid has ADHD, or this one has anxiety or something.
Mm-hmm.
But it really is about saying, as adults, how can I help this kid? How can I get them so they can actually access the academic content I have and meet them where they're at? And so help us understand how we talk to general educators about why they'd want to collect information about motivation or function and what the benefit is of having that information at, like, that sort of just universal level.
Yeah, so when I think about this, an example that comes to mind is, I think, you know, I always hear people in professional development say, we're going to, for teachers and educators, mm-hmm. you know, we're going to give you more tools for your toolbox.
Yes. Yes.
And so people get all these
my
tools.
My toolbox is real heavy now.
No, exactly.
But, you know, you think about this, if you're a carpenter or whatever, right? You know, if I just give you a hammer, you need to know when to use it. When is the right circumstance to use the hammer? When's the right circumstance to use a screwdriver, right? Mm-hmm. Start using a hammer on a screw, it's not going to turn out well, and vice versa. And so I feel like a lot of times we give people tools, but we don't give them a framework for understanding when to use which tool. Mm-hmm. And so that's where function-based thinking, you know, can be really helpful, because, you know, unfortunately, there aren't any interventions that are universally effective with students. And that's the real challenge that we face with behavior, right? It is so contextual. We need to understand things about, you know, why the student's engaging in the behaviors. And so this FBA, function-based thinking, is a framework that allows us to match that more effectively. Because any tool, you know, can do one of three things. It can make things worse, which is the worst case scenario, right? It can really have no effect whatsoever if we're missing the mark, or it can be an intervention that's effective. And so we kind of have a 33% chance of getting it right if we're just sort of willy-nilly picking interventions out of a hat, right?
Yeah.
And so function of intervention allows us to, maybe most importantly, rule out those things that are going to make things worse.
Yeah,
right? Nobody wants to make things worse. And so it's, you know, the Hippocratic oath in medicine, right, is let's first do no harm.
Yeah.
But we fall into the trap if we don't. And, you know, thinking about just simple intervention, like, say, timeout. You know, we can very easily misuse a simple intervention like timeout if we don't match to the function of behavior. If a kid, you know, is in that math class and we give them that worksheet and the student starts throwing a fit and we say, go to timeout, The student's going to say, wow, that worked out pretty well for me, right? And so versus, you know, understanding that timeout requires a time in, and there's got to be something the student wants to be a part of. And that's related to the function. Yeah. If the student really wants to be in that kickball game and they engage in problem behavior, and we say you got to sit on the bench, take time out for a few seconds, like that's going to be a meaningful consequence to them, where they're not learning, hey, I'm getting to avoid math through my problem behavior. And so just being able to use an understanding of function to match to interventions that are going to be more effective, is going to help teachers be able to maintain and support a more effective classroom and work with those students more effectively.
I love that. I appreciate the toolbox analogy too, because I've been in so many PDs myself, and it's just this like phrase we hear. And yet, it is. You're right. Yeah. We need to know. We can't have too many that we can't lift the toolbox. Like, that's not helpful. But we also need them to be marked or something as we're learning, like a hammer, and use it for these three things, or right? These are the tools and how we can get those in place.
Well, you were describing too that the formal assessment, that that it actually has a component where you're doing some sort of like review of data, and some data I would imagine is that we're looking at a pattern of behaviors for students. And one way that we document that is through referrals. And one piece of information that we can ask of people who are directly observing that behavior in the moment is, why do you think that student did that? And it doesn't have to be this formal thing, you know, where you are a school psychologist or whoever. And you can just give it your best guess and just say, why I think they did it. I think they did it because they wanted to get out of the math worksheet. And that becomes a piece of information that when it gets to this more coordinated effort, I guess, to try and understand what's going on for a student because the behavior has become so disruptive that it's taking them out of learning for one reason or another. It's affecting their learning or their access to academic instruction, that there already is this history of people who have collected data about the behaviors that they've observed, and they've given it their best guess at why it's going on, so that when people are looking at that data, it helps them to actually implement a plan and move forward with that, maybe a little bit more efficiently, right? It'd be so great.
Yeah, so, I mean, at the tier three level, that's the, if we're doing a formal behavior support plan for a student who has a long history of behaviors, if we have those referrals, you know, it provides some information that can guide us in the right direction quicker without, we still may want to do the interviews and the observation in that case, but we have some preliminary information that gives us some good help. Now think about this at like the tier two level.
Yes.
So we oftentimes say, oh, we're going to start with check in, check out for kids. And it, it's a great intervention that supports a lot of kids. But if it doesn't support the student, usually, we first check, maybe we're not doing it with fidelity, but the next question is it a match to the student's needs?
It's actually a match, right?
And while check in, check out does a lot of wonderful things and has a lot of supports, for some kids who are avoiding tasks because they can't do the work that's being asked of them, check in, check out doesn't give them a strategy for addressing that. And so we could maybe look at this student's referral history. And if we have 5-6 referrals and they all say avoiding tasks, we might be able to determine that maybe an intervention that is geared towards that. So, some examples like breaks are better is an intervention that some schools have implemented that teaches kids to ask for a break and gives them a more socially acceptable way to meet their needs rather than engaging in the problem behaviors to meet their needs.
Mm-hmm. When you were talking about timeouts, just going to say that reminds me of that, like teaching kids rather than waiting to getting in trouble and getting a timeout versus being proactive and saying, maybe you could use a break and then come back to it.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Please continue.
Yeah. So that link that you're talking about right there is so key and so critical. And it's the shift, once we understand function, then you can say, oh, well, what interventions should we have intervention options? So, I could, if I understand the triggers, I can do things that prevent the behavior in the first place or make it, I'm not putting the student in the same situation over and over again.
Right.
And so, Or, you know, if I could, maybe I can just teach them another way, like you just suggested, to request a break before I'm sent into, and that's working for everybody, right? I'm not disrupting class. I'm not, I'm learning some self-regulation skills.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
And so, and then how to respond, you know, I might be responding in ways that are feeding right into, you know, the function of behavior, mm-hmm. And rewarding and reinforcing the problem behavior. And so we've talked about the timeout example, but attention is maybe even a more common example where, you know, if a student doesn't have the skills to request attention appropriately, they lean into problem behavior. And then mm-hmm. we get down next to them and we say, hey, you know, help me understand what's going on. Why are you doing this? And mm-hmm. and the student's like, oh, I got you engaged. Yeah. And it's because I just engaged in problem behavior. And so, you know, it's a nice response to be able to be caring about the student, but sometimes we would be better off by saying, hey, you can request my attention more appropriately rather than flipping a desk over for me to come over and provide you attention and figure out, can we teach the student more appropriate ways that are going to, you know, in the long term, pay off for them more effectively in accessing attention than engaging in these negative behaviors. Mm-hmm.
So back in 2018, we took a look at how many of the referrals entered into the school-wide information system had motivation listed as unknown, or blank or something mm-hmm. like that. And at the time, I think it was 33% of the referrals that had been entered there was no way for anyone to know why the adult thought a student might have done that mm-hmm. behavior. And so we just recently looked at those numbers for the last school year, 24-25. And it's just under 29% now of the referrals entered still say unknown or it's blank, mm-hmm. basically.
Well, that's an improvement, though.
Which is an improvement.
A little bit.
An improvement.
Slight improvement, yes.
Yeah, there were 4.6 million referrals entered, and it was like 1.3 million of them had no motivation listed. So you couldn't really use them for mm-hmm. the kind of decisions that we're talking about today. So if we want to continue on that path of improving the way that people collect that information associated with some sort of behavioral event, what are some of the things that you use to teach people about the benefit of function-based thinking, like you've been talking about, mm-hmm. In general education settings, and not just when you're talking about students who have an IEP or are mm-hmm. In special education, receiving special education services?
So we've created some e-learning modules and a training sequence called Basic FBA. Mm-hmm. And so with my colleagues, Kathleen Strickland-Cohen and Sheldon Lohman, we've developed and researched these over the years. And we developed some e-learning modules. I had a collaboration with the Kansas Technical Assistance Systems Network, and we were able to create these e-learning modules that you can find on basicfba.com. Mm-hmm. And so we have two strands of training, and both basically the trainings are one, can we train more people to be able to do functional behavioral assessment, you know, on the more formal side, with an idea that could we even get more people so that we can do it, you know, as more of a general education or early special education intervention, not the worst case scenario. You know, we're up against the wall with 10 days of suspension. Mm-hmm. So we have a behavior specialist series, and then we also have what we call a school-wide training series. Mm-hmm. And that's intended more for like general education teachers to train with your entire school staff. And so there's only two modules involved in that. One is understanding behavior, and then the other one is function-based interventions to put these two together. Mm-hmm. And so the first module's, you know, familiarizing people with this ABC framework and being able to understand function of behavior. And in that module, we actually make some links to what you were just describing and say, hey, if you can understand this, this might help you be more effective in filling out that possible motivation box so that hopefully we can continue to get better data and people, you know, having more confidence. Because a lot of times people see that box on their discipline referral forms, but they're not sure what to do with it. And they don't
Not trained to assess that. I don't know.
Exactly.
Yeah. So we So that's one avenue for training, but we really emphasize, like, you know, we can expose people to the ABC constructs and thinking about function of behavior, but we really, really encourage, like, practice applying it to a couple kids that you're working with that you might be struggling with. Because anytime you practice it, you know, you're going to become more fluent with it and understand it better. So we have that ABC tracker form is like the homework task that we ask, participants to take. And if you have a school, you know, team or a school-wide effort to train this, we'd encourage, like, pick a student and, pick a time of day that you're struggling with the student for the next week or two, track that data and bring it back to your grade level team or your, whatever team that you might be meeting with that you could talk about and brainstorm interventions and think about, are there any patterns around the triggers of behavior, the function of behavior that you could, put some interventions to. And, for a lot of people, it's just slowing down. Yeah. You know, when you have 30 kids in your classroom and you're pulled in a million different directions all the time. And, you know, the student's frustrating you, but you just don't have a waking second to to sort of pay attention to you or a framework for knowing how to do that. Yeah. And so the idea is that, you know, if a behavior occurs, just take a note. What was the behavior? What triggered it? What was the response? And when you get a moment, jot it down. And then if we can get 6-7 occurrences, maybe you can start seeing some patterns. And then you start seeing the light bulbs come on and they're saying, oh, well, whenever I hand them this worksheet, maybe I could change the worksheet a little bit. And now maybe the behaviors are reduced. And it's like, okay, we didn't have to do any formal FBA. We didn't have to take it to tier two. Mm-hmm. The teacher's figuring out some more strategies that they can use just by slowing down a little bit. And some teachers get this intuitively. Mm-hmm. And others, you know, need a little nudge to start thinking functionally.
Totally. Yeah. It's exercising a different muscle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this has been super helpful.
So helpful.
And giving just a kind of a real basic understanding of what this thing is. And helping, it's given me some language that maybe the functional behavioral assessment is the more formal thing that's tied to law, but function-based thinking is something that we can do with everyone.
Absolutely.
And it can happen anytime for any student. You don't have to have some formal training to do it. You just have to understand maybe what function is, which we've talked about today, and what are the ways that you can start to implement that thought process into your classroom. Mm-hmm. That ABC tracker is a really cool tool that you all have developed, and the trainings are excellent. I took them years ago just to kind of understand what this concept is, and you break it down in a super simple way. So I really recommend those modules that you were talking about, and we'll link to them.
Yeah, just we'll have links for folks.
For sure. But thanks, Chris, for joining us and helping us to understand what all of this means.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
Of course.